It's hour number two of Shirts and Skins with Chad and Trey. Coming up at 2 o'clock, filmmaker Oliver Stone joins the program. Prior to that, I'm spending this hour with one of the most respected voices in Austin broadcasting from the last 25 years. These days, you can hear him from 9 to noon and 3 to 6 on the Statesman News Network app or by grabbing the show podcast at jeffwardshow.com. He is Jeff Ward. Jeff, thank you so much for joining me in studio today.
Oliver Stone?
That's right.
Really?
Yeah.
Damn. I'm impressed.
Thank you.
Is that him sitting on the lobby? Is he the guy, no mask on? Was that him?
No, that was Bucky Godbolt.
Oh, okay. I didn't know who he was.
No, I've gotten pretty good over time of reaching out to people who represent people who have things that they need to promote, specifically books. And Oliver Stone has...
You want a side gig as a show booker?
A memoir out. You know what?
These days, yes. The answer is yes.
But I also, one of my passion projects right now is a podcast that I'm doing called Books on Pod, where the premise is simple. I speak with authors about their books. And so I've established a pretty good rapport with the number of publisher publicists over time. And I made a hit pretty hard push for Oliver Stone. And thankfully it happened and recorded the conversation last week. And we cover the gambit of the first part of his film career all the way up through Platoon and then some of the other things going on in his life, including time spent in Vietnam.
Did you ever see it has the cast that you would think it would be a great movie, Any Given Sunday?
Yeah.
Al Pacino's the coach. There is Dennis Quaid is the aging quarterback.
That's right.
Lawrence Taylor is in it.
Yes,
Barry Switzer is in it. It's just like a who's who is in the movie, and it was awful.
Jamie Foxx, LL Cool J.
Yeah, exactly.
So we reviewed that movie at one point on these airwaves, and LT was just as maniacal as you can imagine.
Yeah.
Like, they were apparently playing golf on off days, and he was showing up to the golf course and playing 18 holes without shoes.
Yeah.
That's Lawrence Taylor.
He was pretty good in the movie, though.
Yeah, he was.
I mean, the acting in the movie was good. The football scenes weren't that ridiculous. You know, usually all football movies are ridiculous. They're always over the top, you know. But it was weird. It was a trip. It was an Oliver Stone movie.
Well, one of the
A lot of Oliver Stone movies, no matter what, they're going to have that montage, almost like a music video.
Right. And that movie specifically, the way that it was cut is borderline seizure-inducing.
Yeah, exactly.
But if you go back and watch that movie now, he was hitting on a lot of themes that became very relevant in football in the ensuing 20 years.
Yeah, no, he's... I mean, my hope was it was going to be Wall Street of football movies, and conceptually it was good. It tried to tackle heavy issues. It just got lost in that acid trip kind of thing, right?
Exactly.
But you're right, it did. It was loosely based on a book, and who was the guy that played the doctor in the movie? Whoever the physician was in the movie.
Oh, the doctor was James Woods.
Yeah, James Woods, okay.
He starred
so
in his
Salvador
movie. It's loosely
based on a book written by a doctor who wrote about his time in the NFL and tried to pull the curtain. You know, the NFL is going to shut anybody down. But he tried to pull the curtain back on the NFL and say, you know, this is what I was a part of. This is what I was talked into doing. And, of course, it went nowhere fast, but it was loosely based on that, I think.
Well, and Oliver Stone, with as much clout as he had in the late 90s when this movie was made, they tried to get the NFL on board with this, and the NFL was like, are you freaking kidding me?
No
absolutely
way.
Not. So they had to go with, like, the Miami Sharks as the team names.
Yeah, the team names were weird. The uniforms were even more bizarre.
Yeah.
Remember in the, I guess it was the championship game, so Jamie Foxx takes over. You know who the coach was on the other team with the blue and yellow uniforms? They were a Dallas team or a Houston team or something.
Was it Shanahan?
No.
Who was it?
It was Hall of Fame quarterback, old-timer, probably dead now.
Stabler?
I think it was Johnny Unitas.
Oh, wow. Didn't realize that.
Is that right?
I'm going to have to look it up.
Look it up. It's Barry Switzer. You know what he was doing in the movie?
No, what?
He was in the broadcast booth. With Oliver Stone.
Yeah,
it was Barry Switzer and Oliver Stone, which
That's
is
true.
An acid trip just to say.
So
he was the color commentator on the game.
So Oliver Stone, and I'm guessing this came out when the movie did so many years ago, but Oliver Stone is actually a big football fan. He grew up a huge 49ers fan and named the Tony Montana character in Scarface after his favorite quarterback, Joe.
Okay. Wow, congratulations, Joe. That's going to feel great.
So, but we actually talk a little bit about that in the interview, and he does bring up Barry Switzer's name, and he actually talks as a current 49ers fan that he's worried that San Francisco can actually get over the hump because Kyle Shanahan is Mike's son. And he worked with Mike in Any Given Sunday, and Mike was just always the most nervous, worried person. And he thinks that that is now affecting his son, too. Now, I didn't bring this up to Oliver, but I wanted to say, you realize Mike eventually did win a Super Bowl, right?
Well, it's not like they were a train wreck. They were a few minutes away from winning one this past year. I mean, they're not that far off.
Yeah, and they were close with the Falcons a few years ago when he was the OC.
Yeah, wow.
Well, it looks like we
good
are...
Good for you. Man.
Thank you.
I'm envious.
Who's the biggest guest that you've ever spoken with? Because this is probably it for me.
Yeah, that one's up there. Man, I can tell you the most bizarre, the most scariest was David Duke, the Klan guy.
Wow.
It was as creepy and eerie as you could get. David Duke, who was, I don't know if he was at one time a Grand Wizard, but he ran for office, mm-hmm. ultimately won office. He was in Austin or going to San Marcos to give a speech. How he ended up there, I don't know. So, you know how it is. You sit in a studio and you can look through the glass and you can see people walk by and stuff like that. So all of a sudden, I see these two giant goons walk in. They're walking in front of him. And so he comes. He's a little bitty skinny guy. And they come in the studio. They're looking around. They're checking everybody out. They just look like they're ready for war anyway. So that was kind of creepy. And they walked in the studio and I said, look, here's the way I operate. I don't really want anybody in the studio except the guest. That's just the way it's going to be. And then they looked at me, and then he came in, and he was just one of those people. He was as creepy as you would think he would be. He was as cold and calculated as you would think he would be. So I'd ask him some sort of question, lead him down the road of talking about the Klan, and he would do that thing where he's not a stupid guy. He's an educated guy, but he would meander through this whole thing. It's sort of there's these buzzwords that racists use. Things like heritage a lot. Like you hear that, that really means white guys. That's what that means. And he just would meander through this whole concept of heritage when I sort of felt like, first of all, he would just stare at me and he hated my guts. I think he thought he was going to be on a different kind of show. And he hated every second of it. And I don't care about that. But so he was the creepiest. Tommy Chong was one of the most interesting people.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, Tommy Chong, he was doing a documentary during South by Southwest. And I thought, I had no idea how I ended up with him either, but he comes in the studio. He was doing a documentary on South by Southwest. This was kind of ahead of the curve, and he looks just like you would think Tommy Chong would look. He's baked. He looks baked. He sounds baked, but he's a very smart guy.
Mm-hmm.
Not only that, he's sitting next to him. It's just this smoking hot, like 30-year-old. I have no idea if that's his daughter, if that's his girlfriend, if he met her on Runberg. I have no idea. So the whole time, she doesn't say a word. But he did a documentary on, apparently, at that time, the laws were, you know, sort of like sex toys. You can't legally call them sex toys. You can't legally call them bongs. So his house got raided because he was running a bong business. And the whole documentary was about the feds raiding him because he and his son were running a... for sex toys, you have to say marital aids for it to be legal. For bongs, you have to say something else. And the documentary... What is it?
Water pipe.
Okay.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. And so I thought, that's stupid. But then he told a fascinating story. I thought, oh my gosh, we're out of control. He said, yeah, they raided my house. They're climbing on the roof, the whole thing.
Both he and Cheech Marin were very bright dudes,
yeah.
despite their yep. Cheech and Chong characters from back in the 1970s.
You know, he ended up talking about filmmaking, ended up talking about the, you know, I think our drug laws are draconian anyway. So we agreed on a lot of that stuff. And he was really deep about all of it. It was pretty interesting. Really healthy, too.
That's cool. You think the upcoming college football season is going to be really healthy? Big 12 obviously announces a couple of days ago, along with the SEC and ACC, that they are going to try and make a season happen.
Okay. What's happening now is exactly the gray area, the gray space that college sports, where it exists. It doesn't know what it is. Is it the NFL? Because the NFL knows exactly what it is. It knows where it's going. And it doesn't apologize for any of it. College sports is stuck in this space where they are sort of professional sports, big stadiums, skyboxes, TV contracts. They have to answer to university presidents. They say student athletes, but yet the coaches make $7 million. So they don't know what they are. They've never known what they are. And the bigger the TV contracts, the more confused they act. So they don't even know what they're doing because they don't even know what they are. Are you pro sports or are you academics? You can't be both because it doesn't quite work that way. So if you look at it that way, you sort of understand how they have no clue which direction they're going, and they're not even sure who makes that decision. Because in most places, the most powerful person on campus is the football coach, if they win.
Mm-hmm.
So presidents sort of make every decision looking over their shoulder. So there's that part of it. And I think that just makes sense why it's so confusing, because they're confused and they're sort of directionless in general, in my opinion. The other part of it is, and I don't want to go political, but there's a red state, blue state thing to this. I mean, it's starting to come out and be very obvious. So I don't get, we've all been through the hassle of testing. I don't understand why the college sports industry, whether it's the Big 12, the Big Ten, anybody, why don't you just say, we don't know right now, so we're going to push everything back to November. Our bet is by November, we have faster and more comprehensive testing. If not a vaccine, at least we're going to get to this place. Because, you know, you don't have to sit around very long. You can watch CNBC and you're going to see where, for example, Columbia University now has a saliva test. You get a result in 30 minutes. When that goes to market, it's a game changer. So why not just back up and say it's crazy to play now because we'll start and stop. Even baseball can't figure it out. There's no way we can social distance. There's no way we can promise the athletes, nor the fans, nor the coaches, or anybody else, that they're not going to be exposed. What we'd like to do is back up a month and a half, stop everything, and just say we're going to eye towards a start in November. You're going to play 12 games from November to January. That at least gives you space to say maybe we'll have instant testing. If you have instant testing, you can live with that. So I don't get why they're doing this. But they seem to be dead set on making decisions right now. I don't know if that's a TV deal or an insurance deal, but notice how who's in and who's out. It's red states, blue states.
That is fascinating.
It's red states, blue states. That's not just political, that's cultural. But politics is cultural now. Don't think for a second the fact that Nick Saban said, we're playing, and he went on that bizarre Saban-like rant saying, we test our players, they're more dangerous on campus than they are in the football field. Next thing you know, Trump is asked about it. He goes, yeah, we'd be foolish to stop college football. College football in the South is something bigger and more important than it is on the West Coast or in the Midwest.
Well, even in a liberal city like in Austin, or at a liberal university like University of Texas, Christo Conti has been positive about the season happening when it should, going back months now. And so that is an interesting point that you bring up. You know, I do wonder what UT is going to be able to do in terms of fans in the stands. Because you go back even a month, they were trying to get 50,000 people in DKR, which did not seem realistic. Obviously, since then, they've scaled that back to around 20,000. But now Adler and other city officials have come out and said, look, you can't do this to this city. We can't have fans in the stands. Do you think we see anybody in these stands when UT hosts that first home game versus UTEP September 12th?
No, I don't. I don't know how you're supposed to play football and say you're following protocol. Well, by definition, I mean, there's nothing that's less social distancing than hitting someone in the face and laying on top of them. I mean, there's no way you can say we care about transferring COVID and go tackle people. So that's what I don't understand. Right now, baseball has proven it's virtually impossible to manage.
Mm-hmm.
That's not tackling each other. That's with sticks in the stands. So I don't get where they think they're going and how they're going to put it off. I get that they want it. I mean, everybody wants it. I think everybody wants a reprieve. But I just think that the southern states are so desperate economically for this, so desperate for this culturally, they're hanging on to anything. They're going Trump-like on this deal. Because they need it more than other places. Even so with Austin. So I'm confused. Well, the other thing I think is the NFL wants to shove them off a cliff. The NFL wants them out of their way.
Oh, they'd love to have Saturday
absolutely.
Games.
Absolutely. NFL will say, you're done? Good. We'll take it. And they'll be happy about it. I think NFL business is bigger than it's ever been this year. There's going to be more gambling, more fantasy, more numbers. The numbers are going to be through the roof in spite of what people say about kneeling. It won't matter. That game is going to be bigger on TV than ever before.
Yeah, and if they can grab more money in terms of television revenue, considering that they are going to have to limit how many people are in the seats as well,
right.
They'll absolutely jump at that.
Absolutely. Now, they want to shove them over the cliff, and honestly, if I were a network, I'd rather have the NFL. I mean, the college football is a regional sport. I mean, it just is. There's no getting around that. The numbers, I don't care, even if it's as big a name as Texas, you're still not going to generate the kind of numbers you would if the Lions were playing the Buccaneers.
people have a hard time with this, and maybe Dallas and Houston are a little bit of exceptions because we are here in Texas. You go to just about any other major city, an LA, a San Francisco, a Chicago, or New York, college football is an afterthought. You do have little pockets of people who care, but those cities care about their professional sports teams.
Yeah, that's why I think forces are against him, and I wouldn't be shocked that if I were a network, and I know if you're tied to now the SEC is a different deal. I mean, even the Big 12 to a degree. For if you're trying to sell trucks in Alabama, I might need Alabama football, but if I'm a network writing big checks, I'd much rather have the NFL on a Saturday evening than I would a college game.
No question about that. Is it realistic for the Big Ten and Pac-12 to think that they might be able to pull off two seasons in one calendar year? Because the talk right now is that they're going to try and start this spring season late January, early February, play a condensed version of it where maybe it's 8 or 9 games, and then try and play another season starting in November.
After that, yeah. I mean, physically, college football doesn't prepare enough anyway. They don't practice enough. They don't play enough. Mm-hmm. You play more in high school than you do in college. I played more in high school than I did in college. So I think part of the reason why the college game, because they've tried to micromanage it so much, first of all, the rules are stupid. I mean, your knees down, what is that? The interference rule is stupid. I don't think the game itself is managed very well, but I don't think those guys are as prepared as they need to be physically. There's no reason not to be training year-round. And the idea that you spend 5 weeks between your last game and your bowl game is idiotic and dangerous, too. So I don't disagree that they could play a lot of football in a short number of months. I just don't know why you had to have a drop-dead number of September. I don't understand why not. You can play November through January. I don't get it. I don't understand why they have to go there unless the NFL has said, go away.
I wonder if it makes it a little bit easier just for the sake of making other decisions with regards to students being on campus this semester at the Michigans and Ohio States and out on the West Coast.
But I mean, think about this. You've got, I don't know, it's 10% of students in classes. how does that correlate to football? How does that correlate to people in the stands? And none of it adds up. It just doesn't add up. It doesn't make any sense. I mean, the baseball season, even though it's sort of working, is happening right now, but I mean, that's stop and start, and every day is chaos. How is this going to be any different? And they're allegedly to protect the health of the student-athletes. That's going to backfire on them, too.
How legit a threat is myocarditis? That's the big term being thrown around right now by the Big Ten.
You want to go Anthony Fauci or something?
Let's talk a little bit about this. Because
what's your cholesterol level? I don't know.
In doing a little bit of reading, it does look like a lot of the medical personnel at these universities can screen for this affliction pretty easily. And although it has affected some people who have also tested positive for COVID, it's one of those things that you can catch fairly quickly. And then the protocol is you have that person sit out for 3 to 6 months and you're testing them again along the way. And in most cases, especially in young, healthy people, it's something that does go away for good. And those that it doesn't, perhaps their career is over with. But there is also an inherent risk to playing football, too.
If the players, the NFL guys, because the NFL doesn't care. The NFL doesn't care if there are dead bodies in the end zone. The NFL doesn't care if you're coughing and spitting on each other. They own the fact that they just don't freaking care. The only thing the NFL was afraid of was a superstar opting out.
Yeah.
The NFL set this deadline. As long as it wasn't Patrick Mahomes or Brady or Breeze or any of the megastars, they don't care if it's a starter playing left tackle. The NFL got what it wanted. No superstar that drives gambling and fantasy sports opted out. So,
did that surprise you at all?
It did, yeah. It did. The other part of that, though, is, and this is true of college football players are where they are, football factories, not everywhere, but at football factories like Texas or Oklahoma or A&M or Alabama, those guys go there because they think they're going to be pro players. So they themselves disregard their health because they think they're getting the greatest internship they've ever had. They can't miss the chance. They're the same thing as a guy who's number 55 on a roster in the NFL. He can't afford to leave because of COVID because someone's going to take his job.
Mm-hmm.
And so those guys are desperate. College players are desperate. If I were a college player and I really was worried about my health, I'd say to heck with this. I've got 3 more years to hang out. I got something else to do. I don't need this right now, so why would I run the risk? They're just so desperate to play, they're terrified of not playing. So this threat of unionizing has happened before. It happened at Northwestern. They're trying to say they're going to do it at Cal because they say they're worried about their health, and they should be. I think they've got legitimate concerns, but the football factories won't do it.
They may not have much of a choice because there are some federal things starting to happen now in terms of trying to create laws that do protect the players as they come up with some sort of consensus on what's acceptable going forward versus having all these different states decide for themselves.
Yeah, I mean, there's if you're a player, unlike the NFL, where if I miss this year, and even if I'm a if I'm a backup tackler, I'm a backup guard, or even if I'm an aging safety, I miss this year, my agent's probably going to tell me you might lose your job. Someone's going to take your place. In that business, they'll take your place. They don't care. There's not that many Patrick Mahomes out there. In the college game, they're not going to get rid of you. So, yeah, you have to scramble back to get the job back. But I don't understand why they aren't pushing harder to say, what is our hurry? I got three more years here. Let's just back off. So I think they've got a better argument than an NFL guy does to say, let's just stay away. And I think they're trying to do it to a degree. And if the college sports people push it, they're going to run into some liability issues.
Hmm.
The NFL is smart enough to give you a contract and say, sign here or not. You die, that's your problem. The college sports game is just got all sorts of ancillary liability issues hanging around,
concussion. They can't have you sign a COVID waiver. That's not possible. They can tell you what the risks are, but if something does happen, it is on their asses.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we're going to see a lot of, this is not going to happen in college, but it's going to happen at the NFL level. We're going to see a lot of guys kneeling during the national anthem this year as a result of things that have gone down over these last few months. How amusing / sad is it that we're now seeing people get upset when somebody chooses to stand during the national anthem versus kneel?
Well, that's the outlier. Is the person that's going to be the spotlight is going to be the trainer, the assistant coach, the ball boy who stands. You're going to be the story, and everyone's going to watch to see who's standing. I don't know how often you argue kneeling. Yeah, I got to the point in the AM radio world.
Where I don't.
Here's what people just don't want to accept. Because you're offended doesn't mean you're right.
It's a great way to put it.
You're offended doesn't mean you're right. Okay, you're pissed. All right. I mean, this is one of those issues. And people refuse to own this. This is one of those issues with both sides have a point. Both sides have a point, and that's the end of it. If I owned a team, if I was the coach of a team, or for that matter, if I were a player, I would say, minute 42, it's all yours. When the minute 42 is up, put your helmet on, let's go to work. That's all it is.
Yeah, and here's the other...
And the people that say they're going to stay away from the game, there's not enough of you to make a dent. The sport's going to be bigger than it's ever been. It's the entertainment value of the NFL is the best thing going.
Well, and here's the other thing for both sides. Peaceful, personal expression, it's a two-way street.
Absolutely.
If you want it one way, you have to allow it the other way as well.
Yeah, I have no problem with that. I don't think it's going to... I don't know. It's, I do think... Who was the pitcher the other day that stood? Somebody the other day, he stood, and he was asked about standing. And he gave his reasons. I thought, well, that's not getting as much attention as I thought. I don't know if that's because it's baseball or it's because... the guy answered it so well, but he was a pitcher for somebody, and he gave an answer, which I thought was perfectly acceptable. I thought, well, there's a good guinea pig right there. His teammates didn't pile on him. Yeah, all right.
Well, quote.
So I don't. I think it's a mistake, and I think the one area where a coach could go or a teammate could go is say, look, it's your minute 42. Believe what you want to believe, but you have no right to pile on the guy in the locker next to you about what he does. This is your time alone. You answer for it. But once we're done with that 2 minutes, we're trying to win this thing together. And I don't need the two of you ripping each other over you standing or not standing. I do think they need to step in and do a good job of that. I don't trust owners to do a good job of that. Jerry Jones would screw that up in a heartbeat.
He is Jeff Ward hanging out with Shirts and Skins for the full hour. Chad Hastings still on vacation. Coming up next, we will get back into it, including this idea of a vaccine. Is that the end all? Probably not, unfortunately. In this politicized 2020, you got to be kidding me. This is Shirts and Skins here on The Horn.
Marcus can words come to pass. Marcus can words come to pass.
Back here on Shirts and Skins, Jeff Ward hanging out for this hour in place of Chad Hastings, who's still on vacation. Another programming reminder that coming up at 2 o'clock, Oliver Stone joins the program. We reviewed Scarface at the start of today's show when Bucky was hanging out last hour. We'll talk a little bit of Scarface with Oliver Stone coming up after 2 o'clock, as well as Platoon, his time delving way too deeply in cocaine, time spent in Vietnam, and then also his thoughts on the San Francisco 49ers as well. Jeff, have you seen Scarface before?
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
What do you think about that one?
You know, I don't know. It's like one of those things that it's politically incorrect to say you don't like it that much. I think it's meh.
Okay.
I'm a bigger fan of Wall Street.
So Wall Street was, I think, the next thing that he did
after
Platoon.
Yeah.
And he had people falling over themselves to be a part of that movie before he even had a script written.
Did you see the remake? I should have known it couldn't work and should have known it was going to be an acid trip.
Part two?
Yeah. It was at a different title.
Money Never Sleeps.
With Shia LaBeouf. And yeah, that was just impossible to me.
Mm-hmm.
Because you couldn't pull it off again.
He was originally going to cast Tom Cruise in the Charlie Sheen role, but Tom Cruise was already committed to Rain Man, so he couldn't do it.
I was going to say, probably at the time he was worth a lot more money. It might cost a lot more.
I think Tom Cruise would have nailed that, too. Charlie Sheen obviously did a good job as somebody who's all about excess in his real life.
But that's the scene of Michael Douglas takes the whole thing.
No, you're right.
It takes the whole thing. Greed is good. It's like one of the best 6 minutes of acting ever.
Gordon Gekko.
I think it's one of the best six. Ask him how much of that was improvised.
I recorded it last week, otherwise I would. That's a great question.
Sorry,
it's a great question.
I blew it.
No, I've been saying that all day. He didn't blow anything, but that would have been a great question to ask.
I'm just kind of curious. I mean, it felt as real as you could get, man. And I asked John Landis one time. He was a great guest. John Landis, the director.
Yeah.
And I thought, man, I'm going to be that guy, but I can't help it. I'm going to ask him about Animal House, a lot about Animal House. And I thought, oh, no, he's going to hate this. He's going to want to talk about something serious, and I'm going to talk about Belushi. And he talked at length about Belushi.
That's cool.
And I said, okay, how much, because obviously Belushi's humor was how he looked, how he acted, how he raised his eyebrow. It was just these quirky things that he could pull off that made the scene. He goes, Jeff, most of it was improvised.
Mm-hmm.
He goes, most of Animal House was improvised. We were low budget and just winging it.
Well, people make the comparisons between Belushi and Chris Farley, and I think rightfully so. Even though Farley was obviously a little bit on the heavier side versus what Belushi was, they were both known as fat guys.
Yep.
They both had that physical brand of comedy, and both had more to them in terms of their acting chops than maybe people realized in the moment.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, there's some genius into talking less. And then I asked, of course, then I went somewhere else. It was just so, it was really dorky. You know what else John Landis had done? Thriller.
Mm-hmm.
The music video. I thought, oh man, I feel cheesy asking this, but everyone wants to know. So I asked him to talk about that. That was pretty fascinating too.
What did he say about it?
I said, we all had this idea of, you know, Michael Jackson late in life versus Michael Jackson. You know, that was kind of this weird phase for Michael Jackson, but he was the biggest star going at that time. Maybe one of the biggest stars of all time. And then, I thought he was going to say he was difficult to work with. He said, no, he was great. He said, he was a brilliant guy. He was easy to work with, loved producing, liked production. He said, they really hit it off. I thought, that's not at all what someone would expect.
Considering that he did Trading Places and Coming to America.
I love Trading Places.
Did you ask him about Eddie Murphy at all? Because I know that they had a very contentious relationship.
Yeah, he owned it. He just said, we dropped a few F-bombs on each other. I thought Trading Places was funny. The first 80% of Trading Places is hilarious. The last part's a little lame.
Where they have to wrap it up.
Yeah, exactly. It's like every Will Ferrell movie. The first 75% is up, but at the end of it, it's just, it has to end. They don't know how to end it, right?
Except for Adrian Genie. That one just sucked.
That's right.
Speaking of super rich and maybe a little bit greedy, going back to our Wall Street conversation, Elon Musk is bringing Tesla to Austin.
Oh,
is that a good thing for this city?
I mean... Okay, first of all, think of this. You're in the middle of a pandemic. We have no idea of school starting. We are financially upside down in the worst kind of way. Cities are bankrupt. States are going to be bankrupt. But yet somehow the Del Valle School District thought it'd be a good idea to give him some money.
Yeah.
I'd love to hear how you can justify the guy increased his net worth by $1 billion the previous week. I think corporate welfare is one of the most despicable things that we practice on a regular basis. Fundamentally wrong on every level. Do I blame Elon Musk or, you know, Dell or Facebook or anybody from taking the money? Of course not. Because when you run a company, your job is to minimize the risk and maximize return. So if you can find stupid taxpayers, take their money all day long. I just think it's really kind of pathetic to think that small businesses are starving all over the city. And a school board in Del Valle thought it would be just fine to overwhelmingly vote that the guy gets a bunch of breaks. Is it going to make the area? We're going to complain about the same stuff. Traffic, cost of living, all that stuff. Is it going to make, you know, have you heard about his gardens that he's going to build out there? I thought that was kind of funny.
No.
Oh, yeah, yeah. He's got this, he's a piece of work anyway. He's a brilliant guy. I think he's kind of a huckster, to be honest. I mean, I've sort of followed the stock for quite some time.
He has a little bit of that feel to him, and occasionally he'll go on like the Joe Rogan show and smoke weed where he's clearly trying to do something.
Exactly. He tries to talk, you know, he's got some Trump in him that he's a media whore.
Hmm.
Sorry for that term, but where they just, you know, they're just addicted to it. I've got to be, pay attention to me, pay attention to me. It's a Kardashian-like. So there's that, but I sort of follow the stock because I like the cars a lot. I mean, I think there's something to it. He's a brilliant guy, and the cars are brilliant. I really like him. I don't disagree with that. But Wall Street kind of figured out he's always going to oversell. So they just like learned to kind of cut it. Whatever he says, just take it with a grain of salt. It's going to be right here. And so now I think the stock is, you know, I think it's still overheated and overpriced, and what profits they turn are government subsidies. But I think Wall Street's kind of figured him out. I mean, the guy's too much. You must be a big fan of his girlfriend's music or something.
No, I know very little.
You've seen this? Have you
about
heard it?
Grimes' music.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Have you heard Grimes' music?
What is she, dubstep?
I don't know, man. I called it one day on my show. I said, I don't know if this is like Icelandic folk or Icelandic rap or Icelandic something.
Well, as far as the corporate tax breaks go, Kevin Dunn has put this so well on, I don't know if he said it on the Triple Option or not, but he's been on these airwaves for a number of years talking about this ridiculous idea that when a celebrity or somebody who's rich shows up at a restaurant and that person gets a free meal because they're eating there, it's just absurd. And it's very backwards, and unfortunately, it's a sad state of affairs for what's going on the whole here now.
Yeah. I mean, nobody ever wants it. What I don't get is, I don't get how taxpayers are okay with this. I don't understand that. I don't know who you're listening to, because there's never any proof that you give. I mean, there's more proof that it doesn't work than there's proof that it does work, and nobody even knows what the scoreboard is. It's absurd. I mean, if corporate welfare worked, and we practice it in the state of Texas all the time, forget, again, I'm not blaming the companies. They're going to take what they can.
Mm-hmm.
But if your corporate welfare really worked in Austin or the state of Texas, wouldn't cost of living be going down?
Yeah.
Right? I mean, what is my return on the investment if I give Facebook $600 million? Surely I get something back. What do I get back? Nobody can ever answer that. No political hack can ever answer that, because the truth is, it doesn't do you any good.
The devil's advocate answer, which I disagree with, by the way, is that you are bringing more people into the city who make a decent wage, who are spending that money in the city.
Okay, but your cost, if that were to work, you would be doing you're not doing business with every one of them. I mean, it doesn't benefit if you live in Northwest Austin and you're paying property taxes, you're paying school taxes, and you're complaining about cost of living, particularly during a pandemic. Okay, things are really tight. What if corporate welfare were to benefit the citizens of Austin? Wouldn't the citizens of Austin see some return? The return would be, at the very least, my cost of living should go down. The truth of the matter is, for every tax break that some political sellout hack gives him, you end up picking up the difference. Your costs go up. Your costs don't go down. They go up. So what's the point? How does the average citizen benefit?
It's a political shell game.
It's absolutely political. It's a political and financial shell game that's out of control of both parties, and the voter let it happen. The voter cheers it on. My God, a school board. I mean, imagine a school board right now. Life's rough, man. A school board saying, we need money, we need money, we really need money. Oh, let's give the rich guy some more. Wait, what? You can't buy books. We don't even know if you're going to class. And he gets money. Good for him. I mean, But I can't stand it. What I don't like about it is that the average person, when I ask that question, have done it for years, and you know, in AM radio where it's you know, all Republicans all the time, and I'd say, what did you get back? Tell me, what did you get? What did you get from Facebook? So they hired another 5,000 people, and you gave them a break. What did you get?
We talked about this the last time, Jeff. The problem...
At least the soccer stadium. Because I knew the city would not build him a stadium. At least he bought it, you know, is building it himself.
But they're still getting the tax break, though.
They got a dollar, you know, $500 property or whatever that's Chernobyl.
Yeah, exactly. I mean,
the players are going to turn green.
That's about to turn the nuclear power plant
exactly.
Across the street.
It got condemned.
Yes, it did. And the pickle center over there, I think is what you're referencing.
So Elon Musk during his earnings call, which is right about the time he talked about bringing Tesla to Del Valle or the airport or whatever. He went on this wild description of these botanical gardens that he's going to build out along there. I thought, well, yeah, that's great. Like a 737 buzzes your head while you sit and meditate in the botanical gardens on the Colorado River.
Nothing helps plants
exactly.
grow like jet fuel,
right.
Jeff. He is
yeah,
Jeff
some
Ward.
Guy, some guy's going to rob you and stab you in the back, but just go meditate in the botanical gardens all day.
Oh, man. He's firing on all cylinders. Jeff Ward hanging out for one more segment here on Shirts and Skins with Chad Hastings on vacation. Coming up next, one more segment with Jeff Ward here on the Horn. They've got to be esoteric, but still appeal to a lot of people, is what you're talking about off the air. He is
yes.
Jeff Ward hanging out for one more segment in place of Chad Hastings, who's on vacation through tomorrow. I'm going to tell you folks, well, two more times, because I'm going to say it again going into the commercial break. Oliver Stone coming up after the top of the hour. Recorded the conversation last week. It is a great one. You do not want to miss it, nor do you want to miss, if I can get that out correctly, what Jeff and I are going to talk about right now, which includes Jeff... The idea of a COVID-19 vaccine.
Oh, my.
You mentioned this segment one.
Go Fauci on you.
That perhaps we end up seeing a vaccine at some point in November or December, and that's why it may be worth college football waiting to see if you have something in place that helps this problem out a little bit more versus everybody just kind of operating on their own volition right now. The only problem with a vaccine, Jeff, is just like with everything else that we've talked about this hour, it's going to get politicized, and the likelihood that somebody takes the vaccine early on is probably pretty minimal.
Yeah, there's a bunch here. I hate to bore the audience and cross-promote what I do. There was the most fascinating, disturbing, and eye-opening conversation I had with the editor from Politico. Her, over the last 6 months, her expertise has been the geopolitics of the vaccination game. And you think, oh, whatever, whatever. No, not whatever. About the day that she came on to talk, and it was eye-opening. In other words, she's claiming, and she knows what she's talking about, the nationalism of the vaccine, each head of state wanting to be the person on my watch, my country is going to come up with your vaccine because I need that to get reelected. Right? Everybody around the world. Vlad Putin did it.
Mm-hmm.
The day she came on, she said, this is exactly what I've been writing about, is you have this, at some level, competitive, but at another level, political mistrust that's going on around the world, that every head of state, whether you're in France or the United States, is saying, my country needs to get this. I want to make the deal. So we're going to have some exclusivity here that says, if I hire Moderna, you better not get it to the Brazilians. I need it to get reelected. So it's this protectionism that's going into the vaccine game that's now going on, which is really, it's like almost like a Tom Clancy novel. It's now you have the Brits and the Germans and the Americans, although Trump won't do it, accusing Vlad Putin of stealing the research.
Mm-hmm.
That's what's going on behind the scenes, is the accusation that where did he get that?
Yeah, that literally came out like earlier this week.
Yeah, so it's I would encourage people to go listen to the interview I did with her in the podcast. Just give it 15 minutes, and you're going to step away going, "Wow, I believe that." I don't know whether to be optimistic or terrified of what these countries are doing. Not to mention the fact that she said the Chinese have been in phase 3, which is people, for some time. And I said, well, wait, good luck convincing the Americans and the American administration that the Chinese are going to get a vaccine here. How are you going to sell that one? So well, it's in this now, you almost come away thinking this is so deep, so heavy, I don't know what to trust. That said, the vaccine game, I mean...
Here's the biggest problem with a vaccine.
Would Donald Trump get reelected if there were a vaccine between now and November?
It's possible, but here's the problem with the vaccine. A lot of his voters and a lot of people in general
anti-vaxxers.
Are not just anti-vaxxers, but I'll take somebody like myself because I believe this too. It normally takes years of research to make sure that what you're injecting yourself with isn't going to have a hugely adverse effect.
Right.
Just because it doesn't do that in a month or two doesn't mean there couldn't be problems down the road. And so a lot of people are going to have a reluctance if a vaccine is announced by November, December, even early next year that, hey, I don't know if I want to go with the beta testing version of this thing.
The data is already coming back. The data is already telling you that only 40% of the population, adult populations, has admitted they'll take it. So all of a sudden you got a marketing problem, I think. And I don't know how you fix that one. If, say, you're Pfizer and you do come up with it, you're in phase three and it's approved and you know they've already had deals to produce a certain amount. I mean, they're going to build a factory on the Texas A&M campus. But then your issue is I've got a contract with the U.S. government for 1 billion doses or 600 million doses, whatever. But only 40% of the population is going to take it. Like at some point, statistically, it's not going to be effective because two people are taking it. And then financially... we're upside down because the government's paid Pfizer $2 billion, but they're only really selling a certain amount. She said there is already fighting behind the scenes because they're figuring out now. The government has said, we'll do this deal with you. We're going to give you $1.6 billion, I think, for Pfizer. Pfizer's coming back saying, if not enough people take it, we got to jack up the price. The government's saying, you can't do that. You're going to get mad at me again.
Unbelievable.
And Pfizer's saying, well, too bad. If we can't sell more of it, I got to make more money back. And it's a really complicated, heavy, scary world of geopolitics. I mean, do you believe that Putin has a vaccine? He said he vaccinated his kids.
No.
My answer is let him vaccinate. That'll be our trial.
Exactly.
You guys go right ahead.
That's the beta test right there.
If you start getting third arms and stuff, then we know what to do. But I'm not an anti-vaxxer myself, but I think I get where people are coming from. So I don't know where the marketing, let's just assume that it works. The next problem is going to be convincing you to do it.
And
I don't know what they're going to do other than desperation to get you to take the vaccine.
Well, it's the same group of people that are clamoring the hardest for college football to happen right now are the same group of people that will be the most resistant to taking a vaccine. And like I said, I understand the reluctance if a vaccine comes out by the end of the year.
Sure.
Because of what it normally takes to test something to make sure that it is safe for the general public. Now, people can listen to that interview by going to jeffwardshow.com, correct?
Yeah, there's a what they call a snackable podcast, which are a bunch of different segments. And her name's Elizabeth Ralph. Executive or deputy editor of Politico. And it really is a Tom Clancy novel. I mean, to think, she said, Jeff, you know who's out in the lead on this? Who's almost ready to go? And I go, who is that? She said, the Chinese. And I go, wait, so the people that are being accused by the current president of the Chinese virus are now going to convince the current president you're going to save the United States with the people who made the Chinese virus, and they're going to have the vaccine. Good luck with that one. She goes, I know. She goes, trust me, they're aware.
Oh, man. You can hear Jeff every day on the Statesman News Network app from 9 to noon, and then also again from 3 to 6. He's only live.
And then like noon to 4 a.m., and then...
Well, they play it all over the place, as they should.
It's on a loop.
And then you also have the bite-sized podcast available through jeffwardshow.com. Jeff... Correct. Thank you so much for coming in. Once again, I always have a blast speaking with you, and hopefully at some point I can convince you to join this show weekly. I think it would benefit us especially and you a little bit.
All right, fair enough. You do great work, though, so I'm happy to sit in here.
Thank you, Jeff. I appreciate that. Coming up next, it's my conversation with Oliver Stone. You're listening to Shirts and Skins with Chad and Trey. Chad on vacation on the Horn.